Hi, this is Damon Pastolka, host of The Faces of Business, where I talk with interesting people sharing life and business experiences to entertain, engage, build community, and provide information to help others succeed. If you're interested in learning more about one of our guests or how we are helping business owners generate wealth and build businesses they can sell or succeed at Exit Your Way, you can find more information on our website, exityourway.com. Or by contacting me directly, Damon@exityourway.com. I hope you enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Welcome once again to Faces of Business. I am your host, Damon Pastolka, and I am excited for our guest today because we have Mark Stiving with us today, and we are going to be talking about how to raise prices without losing customers. Mark, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Damon. It's going to be fun. And by the way, this is my first live stream ever. So this is pretty fun.
Nice. I feel honored to have be the first. This is cool.
Well, hundreds of podcasts, but never a live stream. So let's do it.
Let's do it. So Mark, you've got a company you formed a while ago, Impact Pricing. You've been helping people for a while now, teaching people on pricing, helping companies work on their pricing. So we always like to start out with, how did you get doing what you are today? Kind of give us a history and how this really evolved.
Okay, you asked for it.
Remember, there we go.
I remember being 12 years old and going to the grocery with my mom and seeing prices that ended in nine, right? 69, 99. Captain Crunch is $1.99. Mm-hmm. So why do they do that? Do they think we're stupid? Right, we know $1.99 is $2. So 20 years later, I'm in a doctoral program at UC Berkeley. I get a chance to play with scanner panel data. Now, this is the data that grocery stores collect when you use your loyalty cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to test whether this 9 cent thing really works or not. Turns out it does. And it works because we are lazy subtractors. I became addicted to understanding how people use prices to make purchase decisions. And from there, it's just gone on. And I can give you the whole history, but that's the fun part.
No, let's hear a little bit more though, because you know, you just don't run into people that have studied pricing, applied pricing, and worked on pricing like yourself. So so it was interesting as you're young, and then you talked about that you were you got a PhD in pricing. So you've studied this a lot. What really interests you so much about this that you continued your education and now as a professional career?
Yeah, I think the thing, I also have a podcast that I talk about pricing on a lot. And when I have people who are in pricing, I ask them the question, you know, how'd you get into pricing? And everybody falls into it. Oh, I got assigned this job. Oh, I just had this role. And I mean, I didn't fall into it, but we all come to the same conclusion. And that is that nobody understands it. And it's possibly the single most powerful thing any company can do. And the idea that people don't understand it is insane to me. Think about how much time and energy you spend deciding what product you want to put together, or mm-hmm. deciding what marketing program you're going to put out there, or training your sales force. And now how much time do you spend on your pricing? And yet pricing is a much more powerful lever than those other three. So it's amazing to me that people don't understand it, and it just has so much power.
Yes. I mean, there's just a ton that's going to come out of my brain here really fast. Hopefully not too fast. Well, you talked about before we got on that you're helping people. Yeah. Usually you're going to help a company that's investor owned company, portfolio, private equity portfolio company. You're going to help tech related, could be software, those kind of people pricing. And I was thinking about that as you were talking and I'm like, my goodness, it's not like I have $5 in cost in this widget and $5 in this cost, and I want to make a certain margin. So I put that together. It's a lot more complex than that when you're working with some of these, especially an end product kind of thing. Where the heck do you really start?
Well, I have a lot of Markisms, truisms that I just use all the time. And the one that I will, that is implied by the question that you ask, is what is value-based pricing, right? So value-based pricing is the most profitable pricing technique that any company could ever adopt. And I'm going to define it for you really simply. Charge what a customer is willing to pay, right? Has nothing to do with your costs. So if a customer is willing to pay you $100, if it costs you 10, you charge 100. If it costs you 50, you charge 100. If it costs you 150, you don't sell to that customer.
Yeah.
Right. But it's that customer's willingness to pay that drives your pricing. Okay. That was really easy to say. It's impossible to do.
Yeah.
Because you can't read a customer's mind.
Yeah.
So now the question becomes, what are the things you can do to get closer and closer to capturing each customer's willingness to pay?
Yeah.
And it takes work, right? It takes thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great point, because that really, yes, we're talking about tech companies and the kind of ones you work with, but it's about anything. It could be the end product of a pen, or it could be a car, it could be whatever. It's really not the cost as much as it is and margin. It's really about what does someone want to pay for that.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So as you're doing this, what are some of the interesting questions or challenges that you've had to work with people on?
Oh boy, that's a really tiny question. Thank you. so I think of pricing as so much bigger than how do I put a number on a product.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start saying, "Hey, I want to charge what a customer is willing to pay," I want to ask you for a second to think about, for a product or a company, two different customers that buy from that company. One of them gets a ton of value. The other one doesn't get as much value, but they both pay the same price because they bought the same thing, right? Now, can we figure out why they get different value? So it could be different use cases. It could be different market segments. It could be different usage. How much is one using versus the other? It could be just the size of the problem inside the company and what other situations they find themselves in. The more we start to dive deep into why is it that one company values it this way and another company values it that way, we start to create these strategies that make a ton of sense.
Yeah.
So when I think about pricing, so much more than putting the number on the product, it's really, have I defined the right market segments? Have I built the right product portfolio, good, better, best, with options? Have I defined the right pricing metrics? So what is it that we're going to charge for? Am I enabling people to do price segmentation? Have I trained my salespeople how to sell value? So you think about all these things, and now we can finally get to, oh, and what price am I going to charge?
Yeah, because there's a lot. You're breaking it down. You're breaking it down into the pieces that make a difference and what we can do. Just like you said, are we able to segment the market between people that have higher and lower value, perceived value of our products? Where are we going to sell it and really communicate that value the right way? Wow, the different use cases. There's so much in that. So when you're talking with people about pricing, how much overall, how many times when you look at someone that's doing pricing, do you feel that they're missing the boat and not charging enough compared to overcharging?
Would 100% be accurate?
I didn't want to go all the way there, but I was just thinking that it's almost like human nature, I think, as we create something, to be worried about charging too much for it. And yeah. I don't know if that's just human psychology or what it is.
I think a lot of it is human psychology. The other thing is, once you get a product in the marketplace, you get a price on it, you're starting to win customers. Now you have this fear. Oh, if I raise prices, I might lose customers.
Mm-hmm.
The single thing that keeps people from raising prices today is they're afraid. Now they don't know what they're afraid of, but they're afraid. right? Mm-hmm. They're afraid they're going to lose customers. They're afraid their customers are going to get mad at them. Yes, many will. but it's just fear that's holding them back.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we're talking about it today, how to raise prices without losing customers, what are some of the things that you're typically going to be talking with these people about? You're coming in, they would love to raise prices, but they've got this fear. What are some of the things that you're going to be examining with them?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to get across is that I am not a fan of across the board price increases.
Yeah.
Right. And across the board price increase, I can understand why you'd be afraid of that, right? You have no idea what's about to happen. And some of your customers are going to become really mad at you. So what you're thinking about when you're thinking about price increases is, what people am I going to raise prices on, or customers? What products am I going to raise prices on? And what situations can I raise prices in? And if we think about those three things, then it makes sense for us to say, oh, how is it that I'm going to raise prices the right way? So let's talk about which customers first, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming that you're selling recurring revenue or reoccurring revenue, either one, I've got customers that are buying from me on a regular basis.
Yep.
Some customers love you. Those are the ones that are going to take a price increase. Some customers are thinking about leaving you anyway. Those are the customers you don't want to raise prices on.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that you are you're a gym owner, and you've got a customer who comes in every single day and uses the gym, and you raise the price from $50 to $60. The gym patriot says to you, "Oh, I'm mad. I don't want to pay more," but he pays more.
Yeah.
Now imagine someone paying $50. They never use the gym. You tell them, "Hey, we're raising your price from 50 to 60. What are they going to do? They're going to leave.
Yep.
If you're a Netflix subscriber, within the last few months, Netflix raised your price. And I can assure you, this thought went through your head. Am I watching Netflix enough to justify the increase in price?
Mm-hmm.
Guaranteed. Now, most of us said yes. Some people said no. But Netflix caused that question.
Yeah.
Now, Netflix also has the data to know how much Netflix am I watching. And they could have selectively raised prices on people who watch Netflix a lot and not raise prices on people who rarely watch Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That just makes all the sense in the world when we think about which customers do I want to raise prices on.
Yeah. Do you see people taking more advantage of the fact that there is a lot more data that we can use now, and analyzing it so much easier when we're doing these pricing considerations?
In the B2C space, yes. In the B2B space, no. They should be, right? But sadly, the B2B folks don't collect all the data they should be collecting.
Ah.
A lot of software companies, when they first launch their products, they fail to put metrics or meters on their features to say, how much is this feature being used? And if they would do that, then we actually had the knowledge to say, okay, now I know which customers get the most value. By the way, that one capability to know which features which customers use also helps us in our market segmentation. It helps us in our product packaging. Why everybody doesn't do that from the get-go, I mean, I get it. It's a little harder. It adds a little bit more complexity. But oh my God, the flexibility and information it gives you, you need to do that.
Yeah. Well, and product development and, you know, end of life kind of things, the decision, well, we don't really, you know, 2/3 of our users don't use that. Do we really want to keep supporting? You know, there's so many different things that it would help. And then overall usage, just like your Netflix case, if we got a power user, that organization is just, they're really using the heck out of it. To them, it's a valuable tool that they would pay more for. Almost certainly.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Huh. So, and this is a kind of a loaded question too, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When you're in this situation, you're talking to someone like this, how much do you think they're typically leaving on the table?
Oh, I think that one's really hard to answer. But I would say it's almost impossible for me to engage with a company and they don't increase revenue by 5%, which is all profit.
It's all profit at that point.
And that's a no-brainer. Now, some products, it's much, much more than that. One of my clients, we identified a specific product. There was no competition. They raised prices 180% on that product. Zero impact on sales.
Right? Yeah.
It's like, that is all free money.
Yes.
And it's because we were able to identify which products our customers getting way more value than they're paying for. And it depends on how we define value in that case, but yes.
Yeah. Well, it is so important, as you said, to look at these different factors around usage and segmentation and who really is getting the most, even if you're using the same product in two different industries or applications, there's huge value differences there. So what are some of the most important things you think someone could look at when they are going to undertake? Listen, we're past the fear. We have to do something.
So if the question is just raising prices, I would focus on usage or find some way to estimate how much do different customers value our products. And then I would focus my price increases on a subset of customers and watch what happens.
Mm.
And then after we've done that, assuming that subset of customers are the ones that get the most value, odds are good, nothing bad is going to happen. And then we start to move down the chain until we get to the point where customers leave us, get really mad at us, whatever happens. Then we say, okay, got it. We're going to stop going any lower, right? We're not going to raise prices on that gym guy who never comes to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never get that low.
Yeah.
But the other thing you want to do is you want to have a backup plan. So what if someone calls you and says, hey, you just raised my price. I'm leaving you. I'm going to quit Netflix today. Right. So you can have a backup plan.
Yeah.
And the backup plan I recommend is a two-phase backup plan. Phase one is, oh, you've been a loyal customer. We really like you. I tell you what, we'll hold the old price for another 6 months before we raise your price. If that doesn't work, we'll just take you back to the old price and leave it there.
Yep. Right?
So we don't have to lose a customer.
That's right. Yeah. And that's a good, because you will get a lot of customers that will just pay the price if they're seeing the value.
Almost all of them. Very few customers call you and complain about it. By the way, every customer inside complains, right? I get a price increase from Intuit for my QuickBooks account every single year. And I say to myself, gosh, darn those people, right? And then I write the check. It's just the way it is.
That is. And it's because you're getting value from it. So how many times when you're working with people or do you see just in general that, hey, we've got this great product and we're starting to go down this road and we're looking at pricing and you discover things that they may be missing? Like you talked about features, you talked about added service or things like that. They go, listen, we were working on pricing, but as we were talking to our customer, we realized that we don't address this value point, that if we did, it would allow us to really, or maybe even hit a blue ocean kind of situation there. How many times do you discover new things like that as you're working on pricing?
So I'll say every time, but it's not blue ocean huge every time.
Yeah.
So what happens without a doubt is when a company starts thinking about what does value mean to their customer, we start thinking in ways they've never imagined before. What typically happens is you've got a product, you create a widget, right? And I have a special tool that I use with clients to say, how do you figure out what value means to your customer? That has four columns. It's the solution, the problem, the result, and the value. The solution is your product. So we'll call that the widget, or it could be a feature of your product, something that you're really proud of. So it's something you want to sell when you go talk about it. The second step is the problem. And this, by the way, is the hardest thing to do when you're trying to define value. you built a widget because it solved a problem for a customer. But believe it or not, most people can't articulate what the problem is. When I ask people, what's the problem? Why'd you build the widget? It's because, well, my customers need a widget. Okay, put it in first person format, yeah. Right? Oh, I'm talking for my customer. I need a widget. But that's not true. That's not the problem, right? There's a problem, a reason we built a widget. I have too much turnover, right? I'm spending too much time sorting through paperwork. I can't find this document when I need this document. I mean, whatever it is, there's a million. I lose track of customers and I don't follow up with them when I need to. Right? There's a million problems out there. And every feature, every product is built to solve a problem.
Yeah.
So do we actually understand what that problem is? By the way, the reason companies can't do that is they have the curse of knowledge. They know so much about their own product, they've forgotten what it's like to not know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So once you can start to think in terms, but by the way, one of the reasons I'm so good at what I do is I don't know your product very well.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, yeah, I was just thinking that right. That perspective, outside perspective, has got to help a lot.
It really does. It really does.
Yeah.
And so once you find someone, you understand there's a problem, you've got a solution. So someone with has a problem buys your solution. What's the result they might achieve? And if I'm working with a B2B company, a result is numerical and it's a KPI. What's a KPI you're going to move for this customer? You're going to reduce turnover. You're going to increase click-throughs, or you're going to increase conversion. What are you going to do? Or what's the KPI mm-hmm. that we're striving to change? And then the last column, value, in the world of B2B, value is always measured in incremental profit. So if I can move that KPI, we should have enough business acumen to figure out what's the incremental profit that yeah. we're generating for that customer.
Yeah.
Right. Now, once someone can think this way, it is amazing how it opens up their mind to where the value really is in their product. And they start to realize, oh my gosh, we have so much more value than we ever thought we had. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would imagine too, that when they're taking that look like you bring to them, that even when you're talking to them, not knowing what they know, because it's like a F1 driver, a Formula One race driver, and someone that hasn't seen a car before starting to learn how to drive, you know, the formula person, they just know what to do. They get in and do this and they don't even see how difficult it is to put this key where I'm supposed to put it, 'cause I got no idea. But that could be the biggest value point of their entire product to the user that they're trying to sell to.
Yep. That is absolutely right. That is absolutely right. And they just don't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I suppose you're generating a lot of extra. Not we're sitting here today, we're talking about pricing and raising pricing, things like that. But I've got to imagine your pricing sessions generate a plethora of other feature ideas, service ideas around the product that really help them to increase the value that their customers feel from using the product. And you know, we start out, we think, hey, this raised the price a little bit, but realistically, we just opened up, instead of going, I'm going from $1,000 to $1,200. I'm not only did we do that, but now we've got another product that's another $500 or whatever kind of thing. They're just these new revenue opportunities that come up out of it.
Yeah, let me actually add on to what you just said. So we're going to raise our price from $1,000 to $1,200. But we've also identified this market segment over here, which gets a lot more value. So we're going to create a version of our product and sell it for $3,000. Right? Then we've got this $1,200 marketplace, but not everybody is willing to pay $1,200. There's some that would buy at $9, but they won't buy at $12. There's some that would pay $15. How do we create a good, better, best product portfolio so that yeah. we get those people to buy at the right levels? Then it's, how do I train my salespeople to communicate the actual value? Because in truth, my customers have no idea how much value they're going to get from my product. And, yeah. and by the way, my salespeople don't know how much value any individual customer is going to be able to get. So we need to learn to have this value conversation. So together, sales and customers can figure out how much value is really here. right? Mm-hmm. Is there value here? Is it worth it? Is this a good decision for you or not? So there's so much that goes on once we learn to think the way our customers think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I was sitting here thinking about this. I'm like, we're going to start with value-based pricing. We really need our salespeople to understand how to talk with that end customer and go, okay, Mark, tell me how you intend on using this product to really understand to help that customer figure out how it might help them and how much.
Yeah. And so if you've done the value table I told you about, right, we discussed a minute ago, imagine that you've created a list of 20 different problems that we solve for customers, 20 real important problems.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to walk into any customer and say, hey, we solve these 20 problems. Let's figure out where you are. We would walk in and say, hey, what problems are you facing? What are you trying to achieve? Oh, that's row 3. Got it. Now I know where I'm taking the conversation.
Yeah.
And then, oh, do you have problem in row 5? Got it. No, you don't. How about row 6? So we're now thinking about problems. We're talking to customers about problems. The KPIs and the value, that comes later.
Yeah.
And that's individual for each customer, by the way.
Yeah. So cool. So cool. Got to just say, hey, to Ronald real quick. Hold on to your customer. Value separates you from the competition. Identify and solve their problems. There we go. Thanks for stopping by today. And then Beatrice has got a question.
Uh-oh.
Oh, that's a long one.
I know Beatrice. I'm worried.
All right. You know Beatrice?
I do.
All right. Significant portion of my research and data parsing is now done using GPT-4. I don't want to lower my overall monthly fee structure, but I'm hourly. So how do you suggest I accommodate this time savings so I can boast about the power of AI and help them elevate their game with the results without reducing my monthly hours? Ooh.
Beatrice, we've got a big problem, Beatrice. Give me a call. Here's the problem. Never bill hourly. Just stop billing hourly. People don't want to buy your hours. They want to buy your results. So when you heard me talk about solution, problem, result, value, at no point in time there was an hour involved. They have a problem. You have a solution to their problem. Then sell them the solution to the problem, and it's not an hour. So it's, you've got to find a way to restructure what you're selling. And now ChatGPT, what it can do for you is make you smarter, help you give even better solutions, but people are willing to pay you for the solution. They don't want to pay you for an hour of your time.
100% there. Because it really is around the problems you're solving. Really around the problem you're solving. But that's a good question though, because there are a lot of people that still do. I mean, you look at a lot of industries, they're still hourly. Mm-hmm. Look at the legal industry and look at might be a great example, but you know, AI can help a lot of industries a lot. And if they're hourly based, it just really kind of goes against it.
No, that's absolutely right. And so if you think about it, take AI out of the story for a second. If you're hourly based, when you first start and you're horrible and it takes you a long time to do something, you get paid more. And as you get better and more efficient, you get paid less.
Yeah.
Now that makes no sense.
Yes. But it's the truth.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Good stuff. Well, thanks for the question, Beatrice. And she said, thanks. I can do that. That's awesome.
Good.
So when you're talking with people, and we've already mentioned value-based pricing. So what are some of the things that people ask you and you go, oh, let's back up. Let's don't start there. That we really need to go over here, because they're going to talk to you about something what they think we should be discussing in pricing. And you're like, let's just focus over here and start where we need to start. But they're going to ask you some of the wrong things.
Yeah, probably the single most common thing that is wrong is what price should we charge, right? How do we figure out the price?
Yeah.
And what's so funny is I work on pricing a lot, but I rarely tell anybody what price to charge. And the question is almost always, before we can do price, we have to understand value.
Yeah.
We have to understand what does value mean from your customer's perspective. And there are many, many different ways to think about what value means from our customers. I'd be happy to go through some of them if we want, but
this,
the real key is understanding the way our customers think.
So you start where your customers are thinking. So let's, I think that's a great segue into, we're talking about value. What are some of those ways that customers really feel that value?
Yeah. So one of my favorites, and this is one of the fundamental concepts I always start with, and that's what I call will I versus which one. So most people, when they make a new purchase, they first say, will I buy something in the product category? And then they go on to say, okay, which one am I going to go buy? Right. So for example, your refrigerator just broke. So you just said, yes, I need to go buy a new refrigerator. Now you go shop and figure out which new refrigerator you're going to buy.
Yeah.
Right? Now, sometimes people don't go on to make a which one decision. They just say, am I going to buy this or not? Meaning there was no competitive alternative. Mm-hmm. So you just dropped your iPhone and it broke. And now you're going to go look at an iPhone or that's it. Right. You're not going to switch to Android, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you buy a new iPhone, that's a will I decision. Now, here's what's fascinating about that is when we make a will I decision, people are not price sensitive. Price isn't driving that decision. Android has 72% market share worldwide of the mobile phone marketplace. 72%. Apple makes 85% of the profit.
Wow.
Why is that? Because Apple sells at much higher prices because we, who use iPhones, make will I decisions and we're willing to pay more. There's no competitive alternative.
The will I decision. I think we just need to stop and think about that. Just reflect a moment, because you're absolutely right. When you go, you know, if you're an iPhone person, you're not going to change. You just go, am I going to buy or not? And if I do, you're going to buy.
It's $1,000. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so let me, since you like that one, let me take it a little bit deeper for you. Whatever you sell today, call that a platform or a base level product.
Mm-hmm.
When you sell an upgrade or an accessory, people can't buy it from anyone but you. They're making a will I decision.
Ooh, yeah.
So now the question is, can you sell the value of the product? And when we think about value and the difference between will I and which one for a second, when someone's making a which one decision, they're saying, let's imagine there's two products and one is more expensive than the other. They're asking themselves, is the more expensive one worth it?
Mm-hmm.
So they're comparing two prices and two feature sets. When someone's making a will I decision, what they're saying is the value of solving the problem worth it?
Yeah.
So now we're talking about the value of solving the problem, not the value of how our product is different from our competitors' products.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Very different sale.
And yeah.
We need to understand that depending on what products we're selling, what situation we find ourselves in, really important concept.
Well, yeah, that would seem to be the fundamental question you need to answer first, because it would affect everything after that.
And people who don't understand that go into every sales situation thinking they have competition.
Yeah.
And that they're because, selling the wrong thing.
Wow. Yeah, because
can I tell a quick story? Do you care?
Yeah, dude.
So I like the smoke. I like smoking meats, and I had this the smoker that wasn't very good. I yeah. And I was walking through the Reno Rodeo. I live in Reno, Nevada, everybody. I'm walking through the Reno Rodeo, and there's this company there selling wood chip smokers.
Yeah.
And I go up and I talk to the guy, and I'm like, this is really cool. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm excited. I want to buy this thing. He goes, this is just as good as a Traeger, but at half the price. And I'm like, well, what's a Traeger? And he goes, oh, it's another brand of smoker. I'm like, okay, let me go think about it. So, of course, you know what I did. Right. I went home. I looked up Traeger. I said, oh, that's like the brand name. I got to buy a Traeger. And that's what I did. I bought a Traeger.
Yeah.
But because he was selling against Traeger, he lost that sale.
Yeah.
And had he just sold the value of pellet driven smokers, I would have had one of his smokers in my house.
That's a great, that's situational too.
Very.
Because you have to understand how, if your customer is aware of the other brands and the other solutions in the first place, because that's a multifaceted program. And it doesn't matter if I'm using the most specialized software to read, you know, results from a breast exam, you know, and to detect for cancer or something. I mean, because there's so many solutions that an individual would not know about. That you could be selling against the competition, or really all you're doing is informing your customers of the competition.
That is exactly right. Let me help you. Here's what I always recommend salespeople do. We're going to go in and sell the value of solving the problem, right? So what's the value of a pellet driven smoker, right? That's what I'm selling. And mm-hmm. then if you want, here's the question you can ask your customer. Never ask, what else are you looking at? Right? Ask the question, if you don't buy from me, what are you going to do? And the implication is there's no other solution. And now you'll get to hear, oh, if I don't buy from you, I'm going to buy a Traeger. Oh, well, let me tell you why this is better than a Traeger. Now I understand my sales situation.
Yeah. That's a great question. That's one to write down. If people had, you didn't get that whole question, you need to back that up if you're in sales, because that's, I mean, it helps you so much, because you just identified, are there other options that someone's looking at? And if so, you know, act appropriately, blah, blah, blah. That's awesome. Yeah.
And if we take this directly to pricing, imagine you're a salesperson, B2B sale, relatively large sale, and your customer is not looking at anybody else. You do not have to discount in the negotiations.
Yeah. Yep. If we're offering the right solution, we don't talk about discounts.
Yep.
Yeah. So you've been at this for a bit.
A bit.
A bit. What are some of the most interesting things that you've been able to work on pricing?
Oh, that's a hard question. Here's what I find most fascinating about what I do is that I have 10, 15, 20 frameworks that I use. And this is how I explain the world, right? You ask me a question, it's like, oh, that's this framework. Let me pull that out. And sometimes I get in a situation where my frameworks don't work.
Oh,
and I love this, because what it says is I haven't thought of something yet. Right. So one of the first things I do when I work with clients is I try to figure out what are the market segments we're working with. And so there's a tool that I use. I call it the valuable features tool. And it's an amazing tool. But I was doing this with a client and it just didn't tell me anything. And I'm struggling to find the solution. What the heck is going on? And it turns out that what I found was that they were selling a platform. So think of Zoom as a platform, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it solves lots and lots and lots of different problems, lots of different industries, lots of different use cases, right? And so they were selling a platform and I was looking for solutions so I could go sell value. And it's really hard to sell value when you're selling a platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so, wow, that's just helped me so much in my realization. What I helped this client figure out what to do. And by the way, this is a great lesson for everybody selling a platform today.
Yeah.
First off, let's talk about selling a platform. Zoom can it can be used to talk to your mom, and it can be used to close a multi-million dollar deal. One of those we would pay a lot for, and the other one we wouldn't, right? Now, the problem with Zoom is you can't differentiate. You can't charge one a lot and one a little. And so with a platform, what ends up happening is prices end up driving down towards cost because we've got other competitors and we're trying to get as many people to come into the market and use our platform as possible. So we can't differentiate these use cases. So what Zoom does, what LinkedIn does, what every platform that's really successful does is they figure out how to layer a vertical on top of that. So Zoom, turns out that you can buy a version of Zoom for telemedicine. So you can do, not you and I, but a doctor could buy a version so they could do doctor's visits over Zoom. Now, here's what's fascinating. It's more specific. It probably solves fewer problems, but it's more expensive because it has some specific solutions for the doctor. And we can decide how much value are we actually delivering to the doctor when we do this. So now we can charge more for it. And so if you are selling a platform, I'm not telling you to stop selling your platform. Go find the most valuable use case and see if you can craft a solution for that use case and sell that solution.
It's interesting though when you talk about that and bring that example up of a platform, because it is so much different than a specific product or anything like that, because the wide variety of uses that you would have with a platform.
Yeah, it's really hard to do value-based pricing for a platform just because there's so many use cases and the value of each use case is very different.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So I want to, we're getting closer to the end of our time here, and I want a couple things I want to cover before we do it, before we get to the end. Now, before we got on, you said everybody's talking about AI, and you kind of had alluded to the fact that you had not done much, but you've done some stuff recently and made a custom GPT. And let's talk about that a little bit. And what do you think, your thoughts on AI and future pricing, how it kind of ties together?
Yeah, so what's the right word? I've been an antagonist on AI, and the reason is I don't know what to do with it, right? Everybody says, "Oh, look, it's going to do everything. It's going to change the world." You watch a presentation, they give you 100 things you could do, and it's like it hasn't solved my problems for me yet. But I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could find a way to upload? I've written three books. I've been blogging weekly for 10, 14 years now. So I was thinking if I could upload my content to AI so that people could ask questions of me. And then if I don't know the answers, could I give a list of pricing professionals that I trust, right? They publish a lot of stuff, and do I trust their answers? And so I did. I was able to put together this pricing GPT. You'll find it on, if you just go to ChatGPT and say find more GPTs, look for pricing GPT and you'll find it. But it's so cool because now the answers it gives, I trust them more than the normal ChatGPT answers, right? Does it still come up with something I don't like? Yeah, once in a while it comes up with something I don't like, but it's better and I keep tweaking it. I keep trying to make it more interesting. So for me, that sounds fascinating. The other thing that's happening with AI and pricing, by the way, is in the world of B2C, because there is so much data, a lot of people are using AI to analyze data, analyze price sensitivities, doing dynamic pricing very, very rapidly to say, "Hey, should we change the prices at Hertz rental car today, or this hour?" Because of whatever the reasons happen to be. And that's a huge advantage to AI. Most of us in the B2B space, we don't have the data that we can go do that with yet.
Because when you look at, like selling a product, or even like you said, Hertz, an airline, somebody like that, if you could let AI work in a segment, just say, okay, we're going to take Reno, for example, where you live, and we're going to let AI try to optimize our pricing by looking at how we're going to raise the rates on flights given times of day over the course of 6 months. You don't know, you could really change your profitability of your organization just because of the almost infinite and just so things that we wouldn't even think about trying.
Yep, you know? That's absolutely right. The one fear a lot of pricing people, a lot of companies have, is they don't want to give their pricing to a black box.
Yeah.
And AI appears like a black box most of the time for clients. And so it's like, well, can you tell me why? And, you know, I really want to approve it, or I really want to say, yeah, let's try this. So
yeah,
the black box thing holds them back a little bit, but it's a great use case.
Yeah, it really is. Well, that's cool. You're starting to see how that's working. So you also mentioned, I believe, that you're finishing a third book now?
I'm working on my fourth book right now.
Fourth book now.
Yes.
Whew. So you've written these books. What inspires you to put it down again and continue dropping this information for people to garner from your work?
You know, I think I'm an educator at heart. I just love sharing what I know.
Yeah.
And so when I finished the third book, I said, that's the last book I'm going to write. And then of course I couldn't stop.
Yeah.
It's like, oh no. It's the third book called Selling Value. I wrote that for salespeople, right? It's like, what I understand about how customers perceive value is so important for salespeople. They should all know this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, that's why I wrote that book. And now I'm stepping back and I'm working a lot with SMBs and portfolio companies of PE firms. And it's like the executives of these companies really need to understand value and what it does for their companies. So I'm taking essentially the same content and Selling Value and retargeting it to executives and CEOs and not talking as much about sales and salespeople.
Yeah. Well, that's very exciting. First of all, I think that's a great way to apply your knowledge, because those people that are running those investor-owned companies or executives, board members, whatever it is in those companies, that is life or death. It's continuing to make the profits go the way they need them to go. That is so cool.
Yeah. And real quick, I hate pitching myself, but I just want to say this because it's so cool. The reason private equity firms hire me is because their whole goal is to grow the valuation of their portfolio companies.
Yeah.
If I can move the revenue by 5%, which is all profit, right? Which,
yeah,
that's a no-brainer, right? So every 1%, if it's a SaaS company, that's like another $1 million in valuation.
Yeah.
So you're like, why wouldn't you spend the time to A, get the price up quickly, and then B, structure the rest of your company so that we can continue that growth path?
Yeah. Well, you're right. Assuming you're profitable today, if you move it up by a dollar, you're a dollar more profitable. Every dollar is more profit, and that turns into a multiple of exit value or multiple of value of your company. Honestly, I think that, you know, while you're working with the investor owned, the companies that we're working with are usually founder owned. And when they can think that way, it makes so much difference in their overall success to building valuable companies.
So what I find, let me say it. I'm going to say it's sad, if that's okay.
Yeah.
When a private equity firm buys a company and the company did such a horrible job at understanding their value and how they could price it and how they could package it, they just handed all this money to the PE firm where they could have done this themselves before they sold the company. So I find that so sad.
Yeah. That's a great point. Maybe a new market for you too. You never know. Never know. Well, Mark, we're winding down here, but if someone's out there, they're in that portfolio company, they've got this SaaS product or tech related product, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, that's thank you so much, by the way, Damon. I've just so thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. You can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm very, very active on LinkedIn. And if you don't mind, I put together a landing page just for your listeners.
Very cool.
The landing page is impactpricing.com/faces. I wonder where that came from. /faces. And if you go there, you're going to find three different downloads. There are three different access to three tools. One is the valuable features framework I talked about a little bit. There's some instructions on how to do it and how to interpret some of it. So it's the beginning of probably the most important piece of homework I use with my clients. You can subscribe to my newsletter. I put out tons and tons of free content. So subscribe and take free content. And then finally, very if cool. you want to set up a discovery call, there's a link there where you can reach out to me and do that. So that's impactpricing.com/faces. And Damon, this has been a blast. Thank you very much for letting me share my thoughts.
Well, Mark, it was great to have you here. We're talking about how to raise prices without losing customers. We all across the board here. And I want to just say, first of all, Beatrice says, thank you both. Huge value today. She appreciates it. So thanks for being there today, Beatrice. Thanks, Ronald, for your comment earlier too. Thanks everyone else that was listening. If you didn't get to hear Mark's from beginning to end, go back to the beginning, because Mark was dropping tons of value about pricing, really not even pricing, but understanding value so you can really understand what your customers want to pay for your product or services and get your maximum value from them. Thanks so much, everyone. Mark, hold on for a second. We'll finish up when we're offline.